Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 250 featuring Celia Hodent, who I met at THU 2019 in Malta earlier this year. And she is absolutely incredible. She was a fascinating person to talk to. She has a PhD in psychology with a specialty in cognitive development, but she's most well known for the work that she actually does in the video game world. Actually, she is currently a UX consultant in that area. She's sort of freelancing now. But she's very well known for the work that she's done in the game Fortnite, which obviously is a very well known game. And she and I talk for a long time about what UX means. It's not just about interface. It's not just about design. It's about an entire perception, engageability, and the way that people interact with whatever they're doing, be that a video game or an application or pretty much anything. So she was really, really fascinating to talk about that. And we even talk about kids, you know, if you have kids and what is appropriate for them to play and not to play. And even though things, you know, different ways that you can understand that. I even asked her, like, let's say I'm going to make an application or something that people are going to interact with. What are some of the things I should be aware of? So she was really, really cool at helping build a framework around things, because I think right now everyone is going to be able to make some kind of an interactive experience or some kind of an experience. And I think that knowing the things that are important for that are really, really cool. So fascinating conversation with her. Really, really great. I really want to thank her for being on. So a couple of announcements. Let's see. Chaos Group events on November 15th in Dubai will be the V-Ray. V-Ray and SketchUp presents V-Ray Dubai Design Week. So if you want to go check that out, you should go do that. November 19th through the 22nd in Bangalore and Mumbai, V-Ray Days India. Discover what's new in V-Ray for architecture, design, VFX, and animation. And all those events, by the way, if you guys want to check them out, just go to chaosgroup.com/events. That's the best place to find out all of that stuff. But we also have something else going on, which is the Undiscovered Student Rendering Challenge, which is going on up until December 1st. We've mentioned it a few times. But just go to facebook.com/chaosgroup to find out more about that. But it is pretty much a rendering challenge that you guys should really do. It would be really cool if you guys would to participate in that. Let's see, a couple of other announcements. V-Ray Next for Rhino Update 1 and V-Ray Next for SketchUp Update 1. They are both out and with a lot of cool new changes. There's a much deeper SketchUp integration that's going on. There's better interactive performance, which is also really cool. There's tons of new controls that are in there, including things like cryptomats. And I wondered, like, why would you want to have cryptomats for V-Ray for SketchUp? But it turns out that there's an EXR.io plugin that is able to import cryptomats. So it could be very useful for you guys after you do your rendering to be able to go into Photoshop and just do some quick mats. So really cool to have that. All right, that's all I got for now. Hopefully you will enjoy this incredible podcast with Celia Hodent.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I was very, very interested in talking to you on the podcast because I'm fascinated by what you seem to be doing in the psychology of the user experience, right? And how that's become such an interesting specialty these days. It used to be, you know, just a user interface that people dealt with, and it was clumsy and just kind of did the thing. But now it's much more of how people emotionally respond to the software that they're working on.
Yes.
You haven't given your talk yet. You're giving it later today, right?
Yeah, in a couple hours.
So since this is coming out afterwards, I'd love to hear a little bit about that. And more specifically, what people that my listeners like to hear is, how did this start for you? How did you get into this? Psychology obviously is a big part of it.
How much time do we have?
we have some time, but I'll make sure. I think people need to know that.
Okay. So user experience is about the whole, it's considering the whole experience your user, so in our case, our players, mm-hmm. are going to have with a product, in our case, a game. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a while. It started, used to be called human factors psychology or ergonomics. With the digital age, it started to be called like human-computer interactions. It was looking into how humans are interacting with the digital world.
Yep.
But in the video game industry, we did not really have that sort of mindset. We were like shipping a game in a box, and like, whatever happens, happens.
Sure.
Today, we are now considering how people are going to experience our games.
Right.
So UX, it's not just about UI. UI is part of the user experience.
Right.
But user experience is everything. It's considering everything
sure.
that the players are going to experience.
Okay.
So it's the art,
yeah.
it's the sound design,
yeah.
it's the music,
yeah.
it's the game design, it's the level design, it's
yes.
like all the things.
All the things, not just the interface, right?
Exactly. So UI is part of the experience, but it's not just that.
Right.
So yes, when we consider UI, instead of just laying out the menus out however we want it, mm-hmm. We're going to try to make people try it to mm-hmm. see if they're going to understand how to use the menu.
Right.
Because the idea of user experience is to take a step back from ourselves mm-hmm. and try to anticipate how other people are going to, our audience is
right.
going to use the product. And it's hard because we are biased. We're humans and we are biased.
Yes.
And we have one big bias called the curse of knowledge.
Okay.
As I am developing a game as a game developer, whoever, you know, whatever my role is in that game development,
right.
I have my own perspective on how I think this thing is going to convey certain information.
Sure.
The problem is that perception is subjective.
Okay.
So I can't be sure that whatever, let's say, for the sake of simplicity, let's talk about UI and icon.
Okay.
Let's say that I'm creating an icon to express that this is your duck power in that game.
Okay.
I design an icon that to me looks like a duck, but you as the player, you look at the icon and you see a rabbit.
Okay.
So now you're not going to understand what this icon means.
Right.
And it's hard to anticipate because perception is subjective. It's not because I see a duck
right.
that everybody is going to perceive a duck.
Is it? But there's also something that's like, it's been done with for so long that people do it. Like, for example, a save icon is a floppy disk,
yes.
right? But
that's
so
a
many people, no one even knows what a floppy disk is.
I do know what I use it.
But there's a
you
lot of
used it maybe.
There's a lot of
yes.
Someone I saw a meme somewhere where someone showed a kid a floppy disk and says, "Oh, you 3D printed the
yes.
save icon."
So this is what we call call a legacy issue.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day, to represent saving, like saving is difficult to represent because it's not tangible. It's not like
yes.
a camera. Like on your phone, you have a camera that looks like an old camera to represent
right.
a camera, or an old telephone
right.
to represent I'm going to call someone.
Right.
So we use a functionality. This is what we call form follows function.
Yes.
In UX, it's about thinking about the functionality of something to convey to the user through the right form.
Okay.
So for the floppy disk, for us back in the day, that made sense because mm-hmm. that was the object we were physically Please. Using
yes.
to save information. But along the way, we are not using that object anymore, and the new objects that we're using are intangible.
Right.
So that's the reason why a lot of people kept that icon.
Mm-hmm.
For us, for people who used it, that was a no-brainer because it was part of something that we knew. So it's part of our own knowledge. So our perception is correct with this item because we've used it.
Right.
But for someone who've never used it, or young kids, or like even teenagers, they have a different perception because they do not know the object itself. So they have to learn
Yes.
this icon that seems completely arbitrary and doesn't look
Yes.
like anything they understand. So that's what I mean by perception subjective. Your perception is influenced by your knowledge.
Right.
Your knowledge, your expectation, your even the context in which the icon is a part of, that's going to change the way you perceive things.
Sure.
So that's a very good example.
Right.
This is the reason why we have to make sure that people know what this means. And it's not because we are at, you know, in our 30s or in 40s or 50s, we know that icon very well, that other people will.
Right. I find it's fascinating, and I really want to dive deeper into that, but I think we're still missing part of your history.
I've even just the tip of the iceberg so far. We just talked about perception.
I know. I absolutely agree. But I want to know how this happened for you. How did you get into UX design from psychology?
So first of all, I'm not a UX designer.
Okay, you're not a designer.
We can dive deeper into that. UX design is part of the big UX umbrella. UX is a mindset. It's about taking into account what your audience is going to perceive and experience and feel, etc.
Right.
UX design is a specific role whereby the UX designers are taking into account the system design, game design, and try to transcribe this into interaction.
Okay.
So let's say that game needs crafting.
Okay.
So we need to design a crafting system. So how does that look like?
Right.
What sort of information do we need at what level? This is what we call information architecture.
Right.
And then how do you craft? Do you double click? Do you drag and drop? What do you see when you do that? That's interaction design.
Yes.
So UX designers design the interaction and the information architecture. They don't actually design the experience.
So where do you come into this?
So, all right. So my background's in psychology.
Yes.
I've studied cognitive psychology, developmental psychology more specifically. And when I had my PhD degree, I wanted to do something with it. I didn't want to stay in academia.
Okay.
So this is when I started to look into what can I do with that sort of degrees in the world. This is how I started to work in educational games for kids at VTech. And at some point, I realized that video games are becoming more sensitive to that sort of things. And there were more video games that being like educational like series games and that sort of things.
Right.
And Ubisoft, where they had that, they still had it, like the games for everyone line. And they were really interested into how to enrich people's lives. This is really their motto. They want to enrich people's lives, not just give them entertainment.
Right.
And so this is how, a bit by chance, that I met them, because I grew up with video games.
Yep.
I understood that, hey, this is something maybe I can bring. And they were looking for someone with a neuroscience or psychology background, and this is how we met.
Okay.
This is how I started in the game industry like over 10 years ago.
Okay.
But then I realized that there is a thing called UX.
Right.
We did not have any UX job titles at all in the game industry
like
10 years ago.
No.
This is more when I was at Ubisoft. So I started at Ubisoft in France at the HQ. So I was working in the Games for Everyone. Mm-hmm. And I was also working in the think tank. Strategic Innovation Lab, and I was working with the editorial team. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to Ubisoft Montreal.
Okay.
I work more directly on a prod. Mm-hmm. So I was working with a Rainbow Six team and working with a playtest lab there.
Okay.
And this is when we started to talk about UX, but it was not even really a thing.
Okay.
It became a thing more when I was working at LucasArts. And this is really what I was hired to do, to boot the UX initiative. But I was not hired as a UX person. I was hired as a game designer. That didn't make any sense because I'm not a designer. But there was no box.
No title for
me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started that way, and I booted the UX initiative, which I did again at Epic afterwards. So this is how it all started. It's really by identifying that, hey, there's a thing called UX that we did not call UX back then. It was more like ergonomics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's arriving in the game industry who so far, you know, did not really consider this, and they were just doing what they had to do, ship the game, and then whatever happened, like I was saying before. But with more free-to-play games and more games as a service, it's always important to anticipate how people are going to perceive your game ahead of time. But now it's critical for your business model when you're free to play your games as a service.
Because you'll just abandon it if it doesn't have that
experience.
Well,
if you're not offering the experience you want to offer, and if you don't try to put yourself in your player's shoes, it's going to be really hard to maintain that relationship, that trust relationship, and entertaining relationship between you and your players. So this is when it really became big. But even then, you know, today UX is a thing, but still not everybody knows what it is. There's a lot of UX/UI type of thing.
Right.
But the problem is that, like I was saying briefly before, you can't design an experience. The experience of the game is by definition going to happen in your player's mind.
Okay.
Yes. As you play, there's stuff happening in your brain, and this is what creates the experience.
Right.
So we cannot design this. What we design is an environment.
Yes.
And we hope as players going to interact with this environment and perceive all the things they have to perceive, they are going to have the experience that we wanted for them.
Right.
And this is when psychology and scientific method comes to play, because to be able to ensure that this is what's happening, you need to test and you need to understand how the brain works.
Yes.
To avoid the caveats that, you know, all the little frictions and frustrations that are not by design.
Okay. But I want to, it's interesting you say that, because I know you said you're not a designer, but you still have to, you're designing an emotion in some ways, or you're trying to anticipate an emotion, or you're trying to, there's got to be something that's psychologically speaking that you can do to say, if these series of events happens, this is the kind of emotion that this person will experience in some way.
Yeah, but that's always been the game designers and the artists and the engineers that are creating this world and make it a live world and bring emotions to people. I'm not doing this.
Okay.
What I'm doing is ensuring that they know exactly what they want to offer. There's alignment, because sometimes there's no alignment on the team.
Sure.
They don't necessarily exactly know what they want to offer. And so we need to make a lot of countless decisions when we make a game. And sometimes we're not going to make the right decision based on what we wanted to offer. So it's more about what I'm doing is UX strategy. I help them really pinpoint what is it they're trying to offer to what audience and stay focused on that. And throughout the development, I help them identify what's going to make their players feel the way they want.
Okay.
Give them tools.
So you're like coaching them in a lot of ways.
I'm just like a producer is going to coach the team in terms of timeline and what they need, et cetera.
Right.
My job is to make sure that they have the right people, like UX designers, for example, to not reinvent the wheel and to make mistakes that are really easily avoided when you know HCI laws and rules.
What's an HCI law?
So that's human computer interaction. You have different laws. For example, the Hicks law. We know that the more options you offer to someone, the more time that person is going to take to make a decision.
Right.
So if you want to make sure, like during a menu, and this is, you don't want players to have to think too much to choose something, well, you want to reduce the choices, or at least make sure that even there's a lot of choices, you have players identify what's the top three that makes sense for their style of play or the characters that they have or whatever. So that's the sort of rules that we use in HCI that we know it's helping us anticipate how people are going to interact with an environment. So it's understanding these laws, also having an understanding, a broad understanding of how the brain learns and what are the main limitations of our brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like perception is subjective, attention is scarce. If you try to teach something to the players at a specific time, if there's like other stuff happening at the same time, we know that it's not going to be efficient because we can't multitask efficiently.
Right.
So as long as you want to challenge players' attention, and a lot of action games are all about challenging attention, this is fine. But if at that precise moment you want players to pay attention to something very critical to your game, you want to make sure that's not too much stuff happening at the same time.
Okay.
So attention is scarce and memory is fallible. We don't memorize very well. We forget. We have like the forgetting curve. We know that we're going to forget a bunch of stuff.
Okay.
So you want to make sure you're not putting too much trust on players' memories just because all of us as humans, we don't memorize things well.
Right.
So that means, for example, having a HUD that's giving away information all the time to players so that they don't have to remember it. So it's alleviating the memory load, for example.
Oh, okay. All right.
So it's
I'm starting to understand, but yeah, you have to excuse me, and I'm sure my audience is actually going to be able to have all these questions too. So I'm anticipating their questions, and I'm as well as my own. So it's very very interesting to understand what that means.
So this is what EOX is about: is understanding who are humans, what are their capacities and limitations.
Sure,
we have some limitations. And this is like in the military, they know that for a while. At the beginning, they were designing aircrafts that were engineered centered.
Right.
So it was just like whatever was easier for the engineer who was developing the aircraft.
Right.
This is what they were doing. But then they found out that even if the pilots were super heavily trained to use one specific aircraft, then when they were moving to another aircraft, because everything was
different. All over again.
Then it was hard, even if they were training multiple aircraft, because when you're right in the middle of the battle, you're stressed out and you're going to press the wrong button, and it led to aircraft being destroyed, or worse, people dying.
Right.
So this is how they, instead of being engineered centered, they became human centered.
Yeah.
Let's look at what are the common errors that we do as humans, and let's design the aircraft or whatever it is to take that into account,
right.
So that the human is going to use the product, is going to have, be able to just focus on their objective and not struggling with the interface or whatever it is. So for games, it's the same thing. You know, if you have to define what is it you want to. What's the game you want to offer? Is it a game for hardcore gamers? Is it going to be super hard, like Dark Souls? Or is it going to be a game like more for everybody, like Fortnite, more goofy, whatever? And depending on what is it you want to offer to what audience, you're going to try to anticipate what are their expectations, what are the conventions that these people know, and make sure that you're going to remove all the frustrations that are not by design.
Right.
Like Fortnite, for example, is not a game about perception. It's not a game about challenging people, whether they're going to identify, is this a rabbit or is this a duck?
Right.
You have games that challenge perception. Monument Valley is a game that
challenges
perception.
Yes.
In that case, go for it. You're going to use our limitations in perception.
Right. That's part of the design. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's the experience you want.
Exactly.
Right.
So you have to define where do you want to put the challenge and where you don't want to put the challenge.
Okay.
And so whatever is not by design, we remove the frustrations for that so that the players can really have the experience that you want them to have. So if you make Dark Souls, yes, the game is going to be hard and it's going to be, you know, not forgiving.
Right.
But if you make a Mario game, it's usually more forgiving.
Sure.
So it's really depending on who you're targeting, what is your core experience that you want to offer. And depending on this, we're going to anticipate all the problems that people can have and all the things that's not by design, all the frustrations that are not by design. We're going to reduce them as much as we can so that players can have the experience that you want.
Interesting. So it's almost if you have a certain amount of ingredients, right, emotional ingredients, and you favor them based on the target audience that you think that that's
absolutely. This is actually the term I'm using. I have ingredients. There's no recipe.
Okay.
For making a successful game. That doesn't exist.
Okay.
What we have, thanks to UX and science and all that, are ingredients.
Right.
So I have two big pillars.
Mm-hmm.
One is what we call usability.
Okay.
The other one is what I call engageability. So usability is the ability of a product to be used. And let's say we have bottles of water in front of us. Are they easy to open? Because what we want as a user is to be able to drink the water that's inside. We don't want to be challenged into understanding how to open it or to hold it.
Right.
So that's usability. And that's common to all the products that I've made all the time. For games, the same thing.
Yep.
Do you understand how to download it, to start it? Do you understand how to navigate the menus? Do you have all the information that you need to craft? Do you know what are the objectives, etc.?
Right.
That's usability. So there are lots of ingredients for that. And make sure you have the right science and feedback that you offer to the players, that your form follows function, that you reduce the cognitive load. That's all usability.
Okay.
But games, a game can be usable and boring.
Yes.
A game is not a tool.
Yeah.
It's not a means to an end. When we play a game, it's for the pleasure of interacting with that environment. It's not just like a bottle. I don't have any particular pleasure interacting with it. I just want to drink water.
Right.
Now that emotional design is important for many products. This is a term coming from Donald Norman, who is the one who coined the term UX. Mm-hmm. Talks of emotional design. He was VP at Apple. If you look at your iPhone, it's really nice to interact with it. So it's emotional. So it's always important for any product to have that emotional connection. But for games, it's critical. Because if you don't have that, you don't want to play.
Right.
So in that engageability element, I call that engageability because we look into engagement. Mm-hmm. Is the game able to engage us? And the main elements there are looking into motivation, mm-hmm. emotion, and game flow.
Okay.
So are we motivated to play the game and to play again the next day?
Okay.
So we have extrinsic motivation, intrinsic motivation, and then we have emotion. Is it satisfying to interact with the game? So that's what we call game feel. Or is it like, do we feel presence when we play the game?
Sure.
Let's say you play a VR game and there's an NPC talking to you. If that NPC is not making eye contact with you, you don't feel present.
Yes.
Inside the environment. Or if you're in a game where there's a lot of AI and you're doing something really heroic, if the AI is not reacting to you, like cheering up or whatever, mm-hmm. you don't feel really present in the game. Or if you shoot in an FPS and everything is destructible, mm-hmm. you have a stronger sense of presence because you are destroying the environment.
You see the consequences of your actions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the sense of presence. The physical reality also is important. Does it feel real, believable?
Not necessarily
photorealism, but it's more about if I'm destroying something, to have particle effects, or is there like a really strong character running towards me? It looks really big and strong. Do I have a camera shake every time the foot hits the ground?
Sure.
That's physical reality. So it's all these little things that make the game more emotional. It's the story, it's the music, it's all that. So the little surprises, the exotic gameplay, the mysteries that you have to solve, all that is emotion. And the last part is game flow.
Uh-huh.
Game flow is about, you know, staying in the flow where you really don't feel any external pressure. By external, I mean anything outside of the game.
Right.
Like you don't feel tired anymore, you don't feel like you need to. And you're hungry, then you need to go to the restroom. When we're in that moment, we're super concentrated into doing a task, whether it is playing a game or at work, or if you play music, or if you're doing an activity like painting, something that you love, when you're in the flow, you lose track of external pressure.
Right.
Good games put you in the flow. You are really absorbed by the game, you're super concentrated, you lose track of what's happening around you. And this is what ideally you want that for your game. So to be in the flow, you need the game to not be too easy or not too hard.
Right.
If it's too easy, you know, you don't really concentrate onto the game because it's easy.
You're not engaging into it.
You don't need to really pay attention. If it's too hard, to a certain level, then you're really going to feel that you cannot overcome an obstacle. You're going to feel stressed out.
Frustrated.
It's going to raise anxiety, and then you're going to rage quit or
throw
your controller across the room.
Right.
We don't want that either.
Right.
So we try to keep the player in that flow zone whereby, you know, the game is not too easy, not too hard.
Okay.
The problem is, depending on your audience, that flow zone is not the same. You know, like Dark Souls is going to have a flow zone that's much on the higher scale for mm-hmm. difficulty. Challenge than, you know, a game like Candy Crush.
Right.
So you try to find out what your audience want, and also within that audience, if you have a multiplayer game, you can have different types of people. People want more challenge, people want less challenge, and this is where it's getting difficult to offer everybody the right level of challenge. So that's game flow. That's the level of challenge. It's also the level of pressure. You know, sometimes it's you have a lot of stuff happening, and sometimes you can relax and think about your strategy. And last but not least, it's about onboarding.
Onboarding, okay.
You need to onboard your players to make sure that your players know all the things they need to know, and at least the critical things they need to know to be competent in the game.
Yes. What I think is amazing about onboarding is I've played video games for a long time, but I've taken breaks from them. So I've had these gaps where the idea of playing a game has continued to develop. And then I was just, and then I come back to it. I was like, oh, game design has changed since I come back to it. Right? And so what I think is really amazing, and this is something that I've thought about a lot, when you used to get a game a long time ago, mm-hmm. when I was a child, they came with a manual, right? And you had to learn, like, from the manual how to play the game.
You really did that? Yeah. I played games about the same time as you did. I never read the manual.
But no, I didn't really. But I
mean, you read the manual to know the commands.
Commands, like which thing to do, push this, to push that, you know, just so you know.
Or to launch the game.
Yeah, to launch the game. Or there was something to just, or install, or whatever it was. And now what I think is such a cool thing is that they now make the learning of the game part of the game.
Yeah, but it's I mean, a lot of great games did that a long time ago. If you look at the first level of Mario.
Sure, okay.
That's the onboarding. There's no necessarily text, but in Mario, the character was really at the far left.
Yeah.
And you understand it, and you need to go right.
Right.
I mean, that's onboarding.
Right.
And you have to jump, and you hit the... You hit the thing, and then you hit the turtle, and all that happens to you without any instructions.
Right.
So when I talk about onboarding and tutorials, this is really what I'm referring to. You try to teach to the players what they need to do,
right.
But as much as possible without feeling that you're holding their hands and that you're boring and that you're just like giving them instructions on the screen. Although, you know, sometimes, you know, games are really complicated. It's hard to do otherwise, or for... You know, some very simple mechanics. You don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, how I'm going to onboard them with this mechanic in a very a meaningful way that they don't even feel that they're... I mean, it's complicated.
Right.
So, but this is what we try to do. We try to onboard the players with all the things that they have to learn. And depending on the complexity of the game or the depth of the game, it's going to be more or less stuff.
Right.
That players are going to have to learn. And if there's a lot of stuff, then you need to prioritize what they have to learn. Because we can't memorize all the things.
Sure.
If there's way too many things you have to learn, you know, like in mass learning, like at the same time, you're not going to remember all of that, and it's stressful.
Yeah.
So we need to spread it out. And to spread it out, we need to identify what they need to learn when.
Yep.
And... Even more complicated, if you have a multiplayer game,
mm-hmm.
You are not, no, it's going to be hard to onboard them, you know.
Because they're in the middle of a game with people who know how to play the game.
Well, right? What you need to do is identify the really critical information that they have to go through before, you know, being thrown into the lion's den.
Right.
So that they don't, they're not crushed by the other players.
That's why you wait for the bus before you go to the island, right?
yes, but it's, I mean, if you look like MOBA games like League of Legends or mm-hmm. Heroes of the Storm, there's always like a tutorial that you need to go through before being able to play.
Okay, right.
The reason why we do that is not to piss people off, is to make sure that they're going to be armed with all the skills that they need, at least the most important ones, so that they can be competent in the game and know how to get better.
Sure.
Because that's critical to motivation.
Right.
I didn't talk a lot about motivation, but intrinsic motivation, the motivation of the things you do just for the pleasure of doing them, not to gain something else. It's a lot about feeling competent.
Yes.
If you learn how to play the guitar, or if you try to be on a diet because you want to lose weight, if you don't see that you're progressing every day, you don't feel competent, and this is when you tend to quit.
Sure.
So in the game, it's the same thing. You need to feel competent. You need to feel that even though you died, you know how to get better, and next time you're going to get better, and this is how you see that you're progressing.
Right.
So that's really the key thing we need to teach players, not necessarily all the game, and not necessarily all the little things that it's not critical, but we want to make sure that they're going to be able to feel competent, even if it's a multiplayer game where we can't spend hours teaching them how to play, because they are here to play a multiplayer game, not a solo game. So we have to make sure, like, maybe we have one level we have to go through to learn the main elements, and then they can just be on their own and go into the battle.
Right.
So depending on what sort of game it is, the onboarding is going to be different.
Okay. Now, you mentioned these two pillars and how they, you know, how you have different ingredients and how to prioritize things based on the user's experience. Now, this is something that I've been fascinated with for a long time in the video game world. It's video game history. Video game, when they first made video game consoles or whatever, they were just considered a toy, and they put them in a toy store, right? And then at one point, toy stores decided that they need to have a boy section and a girl section in the toy store, and they didn't know which side to put the video games.
Yeah.
And it was, I'm sure you know this history, right?
It used to be a family game.
Right. Yeah. And then at one point, it's like, well, I guess we have to put it on one side, and they just randomly chose boys section to put the video game. At which point, then, there was obviously this bias towards male-oriented gaming. But obviously, women are playing a lot more games these days, right? But I'm sure, psychologically speaking, if you're looking at your two pillars and you're trying to mm-hmm. just find an audience that you're trying to deal with, can you use the example of or a game oriented more towards a psychologically for a woman versus a boy? How do you pick those sections?
Yeah, so I'm specializing in cognitive psychology, not social psychology. So
cognitive, I understand.
So
that.
In cognitive psychology, there's like at the cognitive level, so we have differences between men and women for sure. But so far, we have not been able to link these physical and biological differences to cognitive differences.
Interesting.
So there, we don't.
That in itself is actually very interesting.
Yes. There's actually more like if you look at average brains, there are more differences between two male brains than between the average female brain and the male brain.
Yeah, okay.
But it's true that some people are better at navigating in 3D than others.
Right.
And so far, when we see differences cognitively, like you're less able to do something like navigating 3D or do a mental rotation.
Okay.
Most of the time is because in you're not doing an activity that is stimulating your competence in doing mental rotation.
Okay.
And so back to the toys, if you have the toys and games for women and for girls and toys and games for boys, some toys are stimulating different things. So let's say it's hard to do a direct, I mean, we always be careful when we do that, but let's say overall, if you have like dolls and toys about doing a story and making up a world, that's going to stimulate different capacities than a game that's about constructing and Lego blocks or
sure.
And so if now you have two different sections, one for girls and one for boys, culturally you're gonna train these kids for different capacities, and
right.
so when they're grown up, there's gonna be a difference between women and men, but it's not because of their biology, it's because of the environment that they grew up with. So technically, back to video games,
yes.
all the stuff that I'm talking about uh-huh. are true to everyone. Women, men, and culturally, like all the limitations of the brain I'm talking about is true to everyone. But now, because perception is subjective, depending on your culture, depending on your expectations, depending on your past, on your prior knowledge, you're not going to perceive things in the same way. So if you're a woman in China, you're going to have different expectations than if you're a man in California, for example.
Right.
But that's not down to your biology. A lot of it is just bound to your culture and where you grew up.
Sure.
In. So we need to take that into account. This is called culturization. And there's not many people like, I know UX is getting a thing and like more people are into it, acculturization. It's even something that we don't talk about a lot about. And so far, there's only one expert in games that I know of is Kate Edwards.
Okay.
She's doing a world tour every year to explain what this is about and why you have to be careful if you ship your game in a different territory to not piss people off
sure.
or to use symbols that is, you know, means something like the floppy disk
right.
to a different generation doesn't mean the same thing.
Sure.
So men versus women, it's the same concept. We might not have the same expectations, but in terms of games, I think the biggest hurdle that we have is just to make sure that women feel welcome. So if you have a game with only women character that's overly sexualized, Of course, women, most women are not going to feel welcome.
Right.
It's all right to have characters that are sexual in a game.
Sure.
They can be men characters are sexual, women characters are sexual. The problem is when all your women character, and mostly your women character,
right,
are overly sexualized, and there's no other option for women to choose. So if you look at a game, like Fortnite is very good in that, and there's a lot of different characters, a lot of like the skin tone, a lot of different skin tones, a lot of different cultural references,
sure,
and you don't feel that you're not, you do not belong here. And that's the main problem that we have in many games. It's not necessarily the activity, like we, a lot of, if you look at a game like rabbits, raving rabbits, when
yeah,
we have to shoot rabbit,
yeah,
that can talk to a lot of people.
Sure.
Now, if you have to shoot someone, it's military based, and it's mainly men that are in there, and anytime there's a woman, she's overly sexualized or objectified. Well, of course, it's not going to interest women as much, even though the mechanic is the same.
It's the same thing.
So it's these things that we need to take into account to rebalance everything, because we have, like I said, a lot of biases. There's one that's a fallacy. It's if you're, a lot of people are saying, well, why would we target these games for women? Because anyway, when we look at our target audience, it's mostly men. So first of all,
you're missing out on 50% of the population.
But first of all, it's also I forgot the name of it. So it's boring. Come back to me a bit. But so first of all, yes, we forget about 50% of the population. But also, if you're creating a game that's using a lot of men symbolic, and like women, there's no women in there, the women are in there as sexualized and objectified.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, the people who are going to play that game are going to be massively not women.
Right.
And so if you look at your population, you're going to see that, we don't have any women anyway, so why we were right to do that game. So the name came back to me. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
Yes. So, and we do a lot of that. Like we do a game, oh, we don't have a lot of narrative, but let's see what people love. And you send a survey, and people answering the survey say, well, what we care about in that game is mostly, I don't know, the building mechanic or the crafting mechanic. And most people don't say narrative. They don't care about narrative.
Sure.
Well, of course, because the people who just retain in your game are the people who do not care about narrative. So if you ask them what they care about,
right,
narrative is not gonna pop up.
Right.
So that's, we have to be careful. That's why doing research in games and user research and data analysis and all that's critical. But we always have to be careful in what is it we're measuring and what insight we get from that information.
Right.
Because data is not information, and information is not insight. So it's a whole other level to help us try to understand what's going on.
Right. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I mean, obviously, my son has really gotten into Fortnite, and he's really seen that interface.
Good
and
game.
It's a good game. You know what? It was really fun for me as well. I love playing it with him for. But then he got way too good, and I can't play with him anymore. Because he gets frustrated with me.
Yeah.
But it's
you sucked at.
Huh?
You sucked at.
Yeah. Well, at first, because he had never played a first-person shooter before, right?
It's a third-person shooter.
Third-person shooter.
Yes.
I know what you mean. It is a third-person shooter. But he had never played anything like that before. So I I'm talking to him, and he's like, my dad is so good. I was like, nah, I'm just kind of an asshole. I'm in the background with a sniper gun, and that's what I do. And so, but now he's so good, and the way that, you know, that interface and that experience, the way I see, you know, he's nine, right? So just to see how his interactions and stuff happens. And there's a lot of people who are critical of video games and young kids, right? And I understand that problem. I understand mm-hmm. the issues, and I've seen those issues, right? But what I've also seen, as far as the entire UX, as you were just explaining, one is he's developed some really amazing
eye-hand coordination through this process, right? Yep. And that is also something that's very important. What he's also doing is he's playing with a lot of his classmates, right? Mm-hmm. And they talk to each other in the game, and they're dealing with challenging social problems within themselves,
yeah,
that they would also deal with on a playground, you know. Yeah, absolutely, same thing. But frustrations, there were times where I'm never going to talk to this person again, and then they suddenly found out, like, oh no, okay, you know, and they get back along, then they're
so
friends,
cool. I feel like
then
it.
They're friends again. Yep. And then they learn how to communicate, mm-hmm, better, and they learn how to do things, and then at some point they just get really frustrated, and then one of the kids, like, you know what, guys, why don't we all just quit and let's go to creative mode and just do stuff together? And this is, I compare, when people are like, oh, I don't want my kids to play video games, and I'm looking at them, it's like, that's way better. They're learning way more through doing that than they would by just be watching TV, you know?
Okay, well, there's many things in that. First of all, be careful what games you let your kid play.
Absolutely.
We have a PEGI system and the ASRB system. It's actually pretty important to know at what age they can play what.
I do understand that. I absolutely do understand that problem. But, and you know, I am definitely I oversee all the games.
Yeah, so that's good.
So
at
I'm
the
behind,
very least,
yes.
Yeah, but you know, there are some games that are too violent for kids to be able. So, you know, there are things that don't mature until a certain time.
Sure.
And so, you know, if it's too violent there, even if you're monitoring it, it's right, going to be just difficult to deal with it.
Right.
But that aside, video game is a medium.
Right.
Television is a medium. A book is a medium. What's important for child development, because my background is in child development, is that your kid is going to do a lot of different activities.
Right.
So, yes, video games, yes, read books, watching TV, there's stuff that's interesting, and playing sports. All of that is going to be important. What you want is to make sure that they're not, like, your kid is not just doing one activity intensely at the expense of the other activities.
Absolutely.
Now, within one specific activity, video games, like I said, it's a platform, it's a medium. You have great games for kids, and you have games that could potentially be stressful to them and dealing with too much violence for them to deal with. Or some games are exploiting our brain limitations, but with kids it's even more pronounced. You know, like loot boxes, as it is a real problem for kids, because
yes,
the part of the brain that is helping us, you know, stopping automatic behavior is not mature until the late teenage years, like
right,
maybe 19 or 20.
Sure.
So there are some things that can be problematic depending on your kid's age. But now, you know, video games are, whatever it is, they can be really interesting for hand-eye coordination, or stimulating visual attention, or socializing and discussing with your friends what is going to be your tactics, and all that is really enriching for kids.
Sure.
As much as just like going to the playground and play football or soccer or whatever.
Right.
It is, it's just in the diversity that is going to be good for your kid. It's only if they only do one type of activity, then it's not that good.
No, I appreciate you saying that, because I absolutely agree with you. And I'm sure the audience needs to make sure that they are all on the same page on that. Yes, he does, you know, he does a lot of sports. He does karate. He loves to read. He's doing well.
Cool.
He's doing well. But it was just me sort of recognizing the
yeah, video games are not the devil.
They're not the devil. And it's also just like, hey, look at all these things that he's going through, you know. And these are challenges that I think he appreciates. And he and I discuss it afterwards, you know. There was a situation where there was one kid who was really angry. And it was like this. It was dramatic, like serious drama, and I had to call the other parent, and they had to get the kids physically together so that they would realize, hey, you know, you're talking to a real person, you know, and so it turned out just great, you know. And in fact, I think they learned from the fact that the context of what they're doing maybe is not as important as real life interactions. You know?
Yeah, I mean, kids, they take a long time to be able to manage their frustrations.
Sure, yeah.
So that's the reason why some games is really hard for them to handle when it's multiplayer and there's a lot of external pressure. That's why, you know, Minecraft, the creative mode, or Fortnite, the creative mode is better for young kids because they don't have to deal with too much pressure.
Right.
It's really hard for them. Us as an adult, we love to deal with that and to try to manage it. And this is where we get pleasure from it.
Right.
For kids, the level of pressure they can deal with is much, much lower.
In fact, that's what I think I appreciated when the creative mode came along, is that you could sense when their pressure was high. And as a group, they recognized that. And they either by choice or unsubconsciously decided, hey, let's take a break. I want to go do creative mode. It's kind of like you've been on the swing too long. I want to do the slide snap. You know what I mean?
But that's good that they were able to identify that by themselves. But
I think because there was a group, and the group together was able, you know,
but you never know if maybe some of the kids in that group felt that much earlier, but just followed the group. So that's the reason why it's really important. I hear what you're saying, and I'm not saying this is what's happening, but this is what, as a parent, you need to be aware of.
Right.
So the level of pressure that your kid can handle. And you have some people saying, oh, yeah, but this is how they learn. Yes, absolutely. These games can help, you know, your kids learning how to deal with pressure, but only with what they can deal with. If you go, like, way over their head, they're just not going to be able to deal with this. With the pressure, they're not going to be able to learn from it. The only thing that's going to happen is going to freak out, and that could be too stressful for them and raise their anxiety. So you don't want that. Yes, there are games that help kids deal with their frustration and help them learn and grow, but it's always about what is it they're capable of managing at what time.
Yes. I'm just thinking of an example because my son is a 50-year-old man trapped in a 9-year-old body.
I'm dubious, but sure.
Because he was, at some point, he was dealing with frustration, visibly dealing with it, and I could sense it. And before I could do anything, he just said, ugh, I'm going to quit the game. I just say, hey, guys, I'm out. And goes, you know what? I just want to sit down and watch Frasier. He loved Frasier's his favorite TV show. So that's where his old manness comes from. he did that. He did do that. Now, I know that may be a unique situation and some kids can't do that.
And he might not be able to do that another time
because
it's fluctuating.
Right.
If he has already pressure at school, for example,
that day.
If that's putting more pressure, this is when we can actually, like in adults, we have antisocial behavior in games. It's usually because we have to deal with pressure at work.
And we're just letting it out.
Yeah, and that is just at some point, just going through over our threshold, and this is when we lose it.
Right.
So even if you feel that your kid is mature, and he demonstrated that he was mature at some point to do that, he might not be able to do that every time. So it's good that you're here to monitor that. That's really what's important.
Well, I think it's really good that we're talking about this because for my audience, you know, some of them, a lot of them have kids or understand that, and they need to understand some of these things that you're talking about. So I'm really glad that we're able to do that and talk about that because I think that's good. Let's see. Some of the other things I wanted to ask you about. I know that you were working for, do you still work for Epic?
I left Epic at the end of 2017.
Okay.
And ever since then, I'm doing consulting work. So.
Consulting work. That's okay. Friends, yeah. But I'm wondering, you know, obviously, Epic is also obviously taking out some of the things that they've been doing through designing video games and now sort of looking at the broader picture of going beyond just games, but even just creating the tools for people to make games and things of that nature.
Epic is always, they started by making an engine, games, but very early.
But that has become, they're much more forward facing about this now and creating some really cool stuff, especially for the computer graphics world, you know, it's a lot of people are now looking at Epic game engines in the more recent years as a way to sort of create experiences of all kinds. And there's people who've never done it before who are now making these experiences.
Yeah.
And they're not games necessarily. They're experiences for virtual reality. They're experiences for virtual production.
Yeah.
They're experiences for
architectural design, yeah, automotive
it's
design.
It's about making the boundaries disappear. You're not just a player, you can also be a creator and just like offering these tools not only to the game developers, but to anyone who love games or architecture, what is it, to be able to take ownership of these tools and create.
So for those people who have no experience designing those types of things and using tools, you know, like Unreal or, you know, or whatever other systems that they may be using, what advice would you give them as far as like, you know, here's some fundamental, like, you know, steps, things that you should consider as part of that experience that you should put forward as you deliver the whatever experience you're trying to do?
Okay, that's tough. More specifically for people who never made games?
Right.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm working in an architecture office and I've got a big project that I'm doing and I'm designing this big, you know, I have this big design of this architecture piece and I want to be able to deliver a very simple system or interface for someone to be able to walk around their building, right? Okay. And I'm gonna think like, you know, what would I need to be aware of for that experience?
Okay, so it's not necessarily games, it's all more about interactive
experiences. But it's also like, everything you mentioned is still relevant, you know, emotional response, how do you get people, how do you motivate people?
So the ingredients that I talk about that are really critical to games are going to be applicable to anything.
Sure.
So first of all, you need to make sure what is the core experience you want to offer. We have a tendency to add features because we want to add stuff, but we have to be careful with that because we might lose the really core experience we want to offer.
Right.
So always stay true to what is it you're trying to do and who is your user. Are these people already use these platforms, or are these people new to, let's say, like you design something for IKEA so that people can just like navigate more easily and understand how they're gonna, what they're gonna buy and how it's gonna look like in their environment. So that's gonna be anyone.
Right.
Maybe people are tech savvy and maybe people are not tech savvy.
Right.
So you have to make sure that your tool can be used by anyone.
Right.
So that's the first thing you need to identify.
Yep.
What is it you're making? Like really at its core, not all the fluff around. At its core, what is it and for whom? Depend on that, you have to think about what are your top priorities.
Okay.
And then as you start to work on it, you're going to have to use design thinking methodology, which is all about iteration. So you have your idea. Instead of like keeping it in your head for too long, you already start to do mock-ups.
Okay.
Ideally, you want to start with easy, dirty, quick and dirty mocks so that you can test them on paper with people. Like you grab someone who should be in your target audience but doesn't know about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, not a close person super close to you who's going to be trying to be nice and not hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask them if they can do the task that they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
By using a prototype and low fidelity. So it can be just a paper, it could be just like printing the HUD or what it's gonna look like and ask people, what is this? What does that icon mean? Or what is that? You know, if you were to do X, Y, and Z with this interface, where would you start?
Right.
So it's really asking very objective questions on your low fidelity prototypes so that you can do a few iterations on that.
Right.
Once you feel that you're getting closer to that, then you implement.
Okay.
Once it's implemented, then you do a few more rounds to see how people use it.
If the implementation was working.
Yeah. Ideally, you want to have, low fidelity in terms of all the visuals and audio, all the things that people are going to perceive. You want, like, gray boxes is fine because you want to try if is it functional. You know, if you have, like, a box saying, this is where you save, do people understand, you know, how to use it? And are they able to interact with your system? So do they understand that they need to drag and drop that thing? Or is it not obvious? Do you need to change the interaction for that? And once this is sort of working, then you art it up. Then you ask an artist. So if yourself, you're an artist, you make it look prettier.
Mm-hmm.
And you retest to verify with that layer of complexity, because it's another layer of complexity.
Right.
Ideally, it looks not only awesome, but it's also making icons clear. Sometimes it can look awesome emotionally, and then, you know, like something like an interface like looks really slick, but then you lose the functionality of some elements, because now you don't really understand it, and now
you don't recognize it.
Yeah, and your duck looks like a rabbit or whatever.
So
it's helping you to really identify all the steps, what are the problems, and that's going to make you save a lot of time.
Okay.
Because a lot of people, what they try to do is to implement and make
thing.
It look pretty too fast. Right. And then you test it, or maybe you don't even test it, and you ship it, and then you have shitloads of problems, and everything, you know, the shit hits the fan, and now you're like, oh no, what do I do? And it's really hard to disentangle everything.
Right, because some people have already started to learn things, and now you have to ask them to unlearn.
Not even that. Yeah. Like, even if it's the first person using your product, and this person has a problem, you don't even, it's hard to start, where is this coming from?
Right.
Because you have all these layers of difficulty like stacking up, and now what is the highest priority for you to solve it? And especially after you shipped, you released the product or the game, now it's even more complicated, because you're going to have some legacy issues that people are starting to use their product and they're getting used to it.
Yep.
Now if you do changes, you're going to piss these people off. So it's a whole other layer of complexity. So the biggest thing I would recommend people to do is always to think in iteration. Iterate fast, soon, so that you can at every step identify the main problems. You can't test everything at all steps, but there's always something you can test at any step. Even like in conception, early on, you can test stuff. So that, and using the pillars I was talking about, the ingredients, so usability, look at all your signs and feedback, make sure they're clear, make sure you have good form for force function, unless you're challenging these things. They're like reducing the memory load, the attention load, make sure you have flexibility, accessibility. And then you look at engagement. You know, why would people care to use that functionality? And always think about that, the why first. Why are they going to care about our product? Why are they going to care what you use that functionality, to make sure that that you're going to design it having that in mind? So motivation, emotion, flow, make sure you're not going to break the flow of your users. Like a lot of websites, it's always making me laugh. When I go to a website to buy tickets or whatever, and I arrive at the website, I had a goal, I want to buy something, and there's a pop-up saying, oh, do you want to answer a survey? Like, no, right now I'm doing something, like, go away. This is not what I want to do. So I always think about, you know, if you want to buff something up, make sure, so think twice about doing that. But make sure that whatever you offer your users, this is going to be what they want. At that moment in time. Because otherwise, you're going to break their flow.
Well, listen, we're just about an hour, and it's fascinating talk. I'd love to keep talking to you. I know you have a talk today, so I don't want to make sure to keep your time, but I still want to do a Polaroid with you.
Sure.
Because these go on our walls.
I have. It looks like the one I had when I was a kid.
I'll tell you the story about it when we're taking the picture, but it's pretty interesting. Well, thank you so much, Lydia.
Thanks,
has been
Chris,
amazing. Really great opportunity to do this. I was so excited to hear that you were coming to THU.
And just like come to the talk, and I'm going to show a lot of stuff, all the stuff that we took on Fortnite for the limitations of the brain. And there's also, I have a book called The Gamer's Brain if you want to learn more about
Perfect. Totally there. I was going to mention, if there anything else you want to plug, hopefully you've been enjoying THU, because it's a pretty cool event. It's a little hot today, but
it's really hot, but I mean, I don't mind the weather. And people are super lovely.
Yes.
So it's really nice to be able to interact with a lot of people.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.